This episode of The Stack was first broadcast on the 31st of May 2014 on Monocle 24.
Just when you thought you couldn't teach old dogs new tricks or trot out more ponies, a venerable publishing company from the US teaches the English a thing or two about life in town and country. Tally ho for this 92nd edition of The Stack. This week, we leave the independents aside as we delve into that mysterious world of big magazines and how to make them that little bit thicker and meatier. Plus, we'll be talking about the blurring of church and state and whether it's taboo to go and sell your front cover.
Now, this is a very big statement, particularly in the US market. And I think that this is already having a lot of feedback, ramifications, and so on.
Mr. Ian Birch of Hearst Magazines is in the studio today. We'll be talking about all those things, and I'll be asking whether there's a new dawn in digital thinking on the editorial floor, as in, is it possible for traditional monthlies to make money online? Stay tuned for the answer today on The Stack. Hello and welcome to The Stack, Monocle 24's review and analysis show dedicated to that beautiful combination of sharp words, fine imagery, toothy paper stock, and glossy inks. Today, we'll be looking at a new US title that's come to the UK, talking franchising and licensing, flicking through the pages of Porter, and considering the possibilities of profitability for monthlies in digital format. Let's meet our special guest around the table today here at Midori House. And I'm very happy to say that Mr. Ian Birch has joined us around the table here in Studio 2. In case you've missed him on earlier editions of this program, he is the Director of Editorial Development and Special Projects at Hearst Magazines here in London. And I wanted to ask you, Ian, just as a kickoff for all of this, you know, at a time when so many publishers and certainly developing publishing groups, especially when you're in Southeast Asia, I spend a lot of time there. They're always looking for new titles to license. They're looking to develop new titles. How much of your job is confined to this market versus helping your friends elsewhere in Hearst around the world and maybe fending off people who think, oh, okay, it'd be nice if you license our edition. What will you do with it? Versus, yes, we really would like to see you do a new title for us.
It's a really good question. Hi, Tyler.
Hello.
Hearst specializes in global brands. They tend to stick with kind of classic veteran brands like Cosmo, Harper's Bazaar, Good Housekeeping, and so on. So we do a lot of work globally, and the strategy is very much based around launching globally. So once we've test marketed a magazine within one territory, we always try and make that work across all territories. So in terms of my time, I'm much more around the UK market and by extension the European market, because obviously increasingly UK is Europe. But we tend to be seen more as a laboratory. So the good thing about the UK market is it's seen very much as a very dynamic market that's very innovative. In many ways, America looks to us to test things like before they do it themselves.
Is it also because it's slightly less expensive as well? You don't have the high salary. So this is also, it's a different type of laboratory than it would be in New York.
Absolutely, it is. Absolutely. It always comes back to money, as you know. It's always the budget, the bottom line. We do things, and I would say this, we do it in a much more agile, much faster, much more budget conscious way. We're much less scared about failing. There isn't the kind of massive consequences that would happen in America. So if you put a huge amount of time and money into some kind of pilot, you can actually waste an awful lot of money in that process. We're very fast at that. We're very, very lean in every sense. We're lean in terms of staffing, in terms of budgets. And also we prioritize. So we look at one idea, really look at that carefully and quickly. If it's not working, we put it to one side, move on to the next one. So it's a very clear kind of roadmap. And that's something that is much more difficult to do in America because, again, this is a massive oversimplification, but I'm going to say it anyway. There's so much red tape still in America because there's so many different levels. There's still a whole middle management level, which sadly has been stripped out here because of budget cuts.
Is it that sad that it's gone here?
I kind of sit on the fence on that one.
Right.
On the one hand,
from an agility point of view, it's great that it's not there.
Absolutely.
Right.
But obviously from a personnel point of view, it's always tough when people, have to kind of move on.
Yeah.
But yes, it's certainly made us a great deal faster, a great deal more agile. Mm. And obviously we have to do that because everything is now being done cross-platform. So it's ideas can now, which is what's really exciting, an idea can bubble up via an event, via online,
sure,
via social media platform, via print platform. Mm. That's what makes it so much more interesting. And that's another reason why you have to be that much more agile. And the kind of people you use to do it have got to think in a multi-platform way.
Yep.
And think about, you know, what is the most important thing here? Is it to be across 10 different platforms? I would say no. What is the one or two key platforms that would make this work? So is a huge event much more useful than having 2.5 million Twitter followers? Because, I mean, it's kind of macho thing to say that, but it doesn't always necessarily translate into kind of finance, having those kind of social media numbers.
When you talk about agility, for a company like Hearst, is that about time to market or is it also about development as well? Because if I think of just, you of course already listed, you know, just a series of titles, you know, not even sort of hitting Esquire and others, you know, you have this enormous catalog, you've got this incredible stable. So for you, is it just, okay, can you get a new edition out in Thailand quick enough? Can you make the Indonesian edition happen? Is it about that or is it also still about developing new things as well and saying, look at, you know, Ian Birch came up with this great idea. They've hothoused it in London. You know, we think that this would be great to bring to market.
It's both. It's absolutely both. Because I'm less involved, as I said before, with the international, but because all the major publishing houses, as you know, as well as me, if not better, are looking to launch in those new emerging markets. So Condé Nast is competing with Hearst, competing with Bauer, competing with Berta, etc., to be first off the marks in China, in Russia, the Asian Pacific, and so on and so forth. So speed there is more important than ever. And then secondly, in parallel, we have to hothouse in a much faster and much more kind of, like, just take research, for example. The traditional way of doing research back in the day was to do long process where you go over to focus groups, you do very in-depth and very useful.
Yeah.
But actually, it's not that useful for the early stages of a new project. It's much better to throw something up online very quickly, get much more of a kind of crowdfunding, crowd-involved way to get a sense of, is there even an idea here? And that is unbelievably helpful because if there is an idea, we know how to take that and then develop it.
Right. Let me ask you, and I jumped into one of our local newsstands a couple of weeks ago, and I was looking for the U.S. edition of Town & Country, and then I saw this thumping Town & Country, the best of both worlds, being the supporting cover line, and it's at first issue, summer 2014. I thought, God, I thought, they've launched a British edition, and it completely, I missed the press release, everything. There it is, £5.95. So I have to ask you, what took you so long? Because once upon a time I was a fan of Town & Country. Then it kind of went off the rails. I think the U.S. edition has been amazing under its new editor. It's sparky, it's smart. There's good journalism, and it's fun. It brings sort of a level of fun and sass and wit, I think, to a sector which is oftentimes a little bit too fawning. And so it's wonderful what's happened with the U.S. edition. Again, was it new vitality on the editorial floor in America that gave you, the courage to say, let's bring it to the UK market?
Yes, it was both. It was both new vitality. Jay, as you say, the American editor, fantastic. I know him quite well.
Last port of call was probably Men's Vogue, wasn't it?
Correct, correct. So he, fantastic energy, fantastic commitment, a new vision. So because I'd been working in New York, I got to know him and this began to bubble up.
Mm-hmm.
So there was, on the personal side, on the specific brand side, the people side, and then on the kind of global strategy side, Town & Country is the kind of title that we think that could be launched globally.
Because in fact, there is a Thai edition now as well.
There is a Thai edition.
Which is well done.
Yeah, absolutely. But if you want, and this is not meant to sound arrogant, but if you want to launch a global edition of something, it's really important to have a UK version because it helps generate content. Because the more content we can generate for the whole global network, the better. So if we work closely with the Americans, so we have a lot of UK and a lot of US content.
And you will definitely, even with this up and running, you'll see traffic going both ways? Because sometimes that is a challenge. When you speak to a sophisticated audience, you know, I hope that I'll still be able to find the American edition on British newsstands because I want both. And then sometimes your frustration is with licensed editions. Like, oh, God, I just saw that story.
Yeah, yeah. No, well, the key is to try and keep a balance between the two. So you want the brand values to be absolutely apparent in all editions.
Yep.
And we're very clear about what those are now. Mm-hmm. But we also want a unique domestic, if you like, interpretation. So this first issue is very deliberately, and I say it proudly, a very, very British take on the town and country brand vision. Mm. So everything in here is about the UK, as opposed to taking from the US at this stage, because it's important at this stage for us to say there is a very strong UK market that is sympathetic with but different to the US market.
Yes. I'm looking at a story here shot by Julian Broad. Headline is Finding Avalon. And we see Lucy Burley, and of course people will know her as the former Mrs. Brian Ferry, spends weekends in Shropshire, or spends weekdays in Shropshire and weekends in Knightsbridge, all in impeccable English style. And we go through this, you know, wonderful reportage and just good old classic glossy magazine lads, not trying to be tricky. It's very readable.
You know, it's very traditional in the best sense.
In the best sense of the word. And then we were talking just last week, we had our own creative director saying that, you know, when glossies do it well still, and they often get run down, you can't beat them.
I couldn't agree with you more. And that's, I mean, I agree with you 150%. And a very good example of that is the paper quality. The paper quality in the first issue of Town & Country is exceptional.
You can hear the snap, ladies and
gentlemen.
Exactly.
Yeah. And when was the last time you heard a snap like that?
Yeah.
Certainly not the weekly
market. No, I mean, and definitely not. I mean, we haven't seen it for a long time, I think, you know, amongst your competitors on the other side of Regent Street as well. I mean, we've seen a downgrade in a lot of paper quality. Yeah. And you know, it's interesting. A lot of companies have been sold on this new type of gloss, which has this really disgusting filminess to it. And I felt in a lot of magazines now, it's just not very nice. And this is, I can say, you know, congratulations. And
good at
this. But does this cause a problem? Because then suddenly you've got Jay in the States saying, hey, wait a second, Hearst board members, look at this like thumping thing that came out in the UK. I want thicker paper stock on the US edition.
I couldn't possibly comment on that. But the good news is, Jay, the US team and the UK team have been talking about this very closely for the last 18 months.
Right.
And we have been exchanging ideas and we are beginning to work much more closely together. So as I said before, on the one hand, we want to be very collegial and work together. Mm. On the other hand, we want to very much point out our differences.
Sure.
Because a global brand, as you know, it's important that the umbrella brand values are clear, but the domestic interpretation is also different.
Has this already shaken up the newsstand? Do you already feel that, of course, and everyone who knows the British newsstand well, and also Southeast Asian newsstands as well, will know the Tatler brand. Now, of course, the Tatler brand that sits here is owned by Condé Nast. It's licensed to Eddie Press throughout Southeast Asia. But nevertheless, you know, I would say if I looked at your Thai edition, you know, you're definitely going after Tatler in that market, a magazine which gets, you know, many more pages than the British edition does. So would you say it's, you create a bit of a war?
When you launch something new, the last thing you want to think about is your competition. Mm. And I'm not trying to sound idealistic there.
Just a little, but anyway.
But I think what you have to do straight away is say, is this different and is this good? Mm. And then the third question is, who do we compete with? So it's not that it's not an important question, but it's got to be, is it different and is it good? And does it service a new need? So the classic thing I always think we should do is with something like this is there an unmet need out there in the market? And if so, does this satisfy that need? Mm. And so we looked at the whole kind of the new affluent market and particularly the new affluent international market, about which you know a great deal too. And we felt, because we had a brand like Town & Country, it was the perfect time to start, if you like, rejuvenating it, rekindling it, because the market was there in a way it wasn't maybe 5-10 years ago, because we were all going through a sort of ghastly recession and so on.
Yeah. And finally, just before we go to a break, I think the other thing that it does is it even rejuvenates the mothership as well.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think we should do... You know, what we would like to do is think about actually commissioning content together And I think that's a nice way for both. Now, that's not going to happen tomorrow, but it will be part of a process over the next, you know, year, whatever, 18 months.
You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. My guest today is Ian Birch of Hearst, just around the corner here in London. We're going away for a short break, but we're back right after this.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
And it's a Saturday afternoon here in London, actually morning, in fact, and you're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. And I'm saying afternoon because sometimes I do put myself in the mindset that are people really up that early on a Saturday listening to this, or are they already on Asian time tuning in to this program? We're talking about town and country, Ian, just before we went away to the break. Now, you brought a variety of other things in. We have Time magazine. Of course, there's been a bit of a shift and shakeup at Bloomberg Businessweek. Someone new taking the helm there, of course, their creative director going off to MTV. Where did you want to start? We've got a sort of variety of things here.
The kind of big news, I think, in media land is what Time is doing with their cover. Mm. So, as you probably know, they have put an ad on the cover for the first time in the history of Time magazine. It will also appear on Sports Illustrated, two of the biggest weekly magazines, as you know, in America. Now, this, to some people, may not be that interesting, but is a very big kind of statement, particularly in the US market. Mm. Because in the US market, my experience is the division, if you like, between church and state, between content and advertising, is much greater than it is, say, in the UK or in Europe. And I think that this is already having a lot of feedback, ramifications, and so on.
It makes a lot of news because, this has happened in the States, and where we know that there is a pretty solid wall still between church and state. Some bricks are being removed in some publishing companies, others not. In this case, it's Verizon, who is going to be the partner on the cover of the magazine. It's just a very clear case of someone jumping on a plane, maybe being in Southeast Asia or somewhere else in the world, Ian, where they've seen, listen, you know, because of course, you know, we've seen this in other markets. It's not exactly new. It's very bold that a news and current affairs title like Time is doing it. But you can venture up to Helsinki. You can look at Helsinki and Sanomat daily newspaper. They've been selling their front cover for years, where you can have this cover up. Even the New York Times, as you know, during fashion weeks, etc., you can buy the front cover of the New York Times, and it can be sort of wrapped in Burberry or Lanvin or whoever. So, A, is it that big news that Time is doing it? And does it suddenly, of course, open up the floodgates for everybody else?
I don't think it is big news outside of America. Mm. I completely agree with you. I mean, the Telegraph here is doing it. They're doing fashion wraps or advertising wraps almost every weekend. Mm. You know, Stylus magazine giveaways do it virtually every week.
Yep.
So I don't think it is outside, but I think there it is. And I think also, there is a kind of political with a small p level here, because the American Society of Magazine Editors, which is one of the big kind of boards in the US, is a very powerful lobby and is much more powerful than, say, its UK contemporary, parallel rather, the British Society.
I mean, it almost behaves more like a union.
Absolutely it does. And the result of that is that's why the church and state division is that much more kind of hotly contested, discussed, debated, whatever. So I'm interested to see how ASME will respond. Mm. I haven't yet seen that so far, because I had some experience for this when I was editing in America. And you have to be so much more careful, or rather you did have to be so much more careful about what you could put on covers, what you could reference and so on.
Yes.
Completely different to the UK. Mm. So that in itself, I think, is interesting. But I've been looking at some of the reactions, actually, that people have had. And I think it's worth bearing in mind that at the moment, this is a tiny ad.
Sure.
It's under the mailbox, you know, the subscriber's mailbox.
Yeah.
And all it says is, for best results, use Verizon, see page 23.
Yeah.
But it's clearly
and it's good you clarified that they haven't sort of put a second cover around the magazine or something like that.
Which I think is important just to kind
of... Sure, absolutely.
But clearly what it's doing is opening some kind of gate.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the other thing is, And maybe this is too political, but the timing is very important because this is happening just before Time Inc. actually goes up for sale.
Exactly.
So I think that sends a message out to potential investors, mm-hmm. advertising communities, et cetera.
Yes, we're nimble, we're agile. And I would imagine when people start to do their due diligence in the business, you know, does this become, you know, part of their bigger story? And I would say that part of the bigger story that they probably need to create, because we've seen a number of changes and announcements, maybe even some close to your office as well, that there's a big rethink going on in London at the moment in terms of the monthly magazine and digital and cutbacks. So it's part of this move as well to say, everyone's talked a very good game, Ian, about whether you're a weekly magazine or monthly magazine, about all of the delights and fortunes that are going to be made digitally. But suddenly we're seeing a lot of editorial departments simply cut back because people still can't square and make it work.
No, they can, because at the moment, the digital revenue is no way offsetting the loss in print revenue. Mm. It's as simple as that. Will it change? May well be, but it hasn't.
But we don't know, right?
We don't know, and it's a very, very slow process.
It's interesting that we've arrived at, you know, at least at this part of the program and that part of the discussion about we don't know, we're not sure, as opposed to maybe 3 years ago, 7 years ago, was, oh, it will absolutely get there. And this is what it's going to look like. And I can remember being in presentations where other media companies or other partners have said, okay, you have to come into our world because this is exactly where the tablet's going to go. This is how big your digital team needs to be. And what are we seeing? And it was amazing. We started looking through it. Even magazines that I really like, you know, World of Interiors barely has a website. I mean, there are a lot of magazines you think, oh, well, they've got these big, well-oiled teams, and if I want to find out what, well, at least in the case of when I was talking to my editor, Andrew Tuck, about what kind of paints you might want, you go to World Interiors. You know, there is no resource. You can subscribe to the magazine, but that's about it. And I think we're seeing actually more monthly has actually moved back into that territory because they simply can't sustain the team.
Yeah. No, I completely agree with you. We don't know where we are in many ways, and trying to make rash kind of predictions is madness at the moment. Mm. One of the things that's interesting at the moment, that we're beginning to see this gently bubble up in our research at the moment, is there really does seem to be a kind of rekindled interest in print, which is kind of ironic in the light of everything you're saying, you know, but very, very heartwarming too. We're seeing this kind of more and more, particularly at the older end. By older, I mean 35 plus, and at the more affluent end of the market. And what we're seeing, and again, it's very early stages, is that people are actually saying to us, don't take away my print.
Yeah.
Which is fantastic, because they're seeing it as more and more an escape from an accelerated world, because everything's so crazy. Print is an oasis of calm.
And in many ways, yeah, that the screen, yes, it's part of entertainment, but in fact, the screen is actually more about work.
Absolutely, it is. And I think also, you remember that phrase, me time, which was around a few years ago. That's coming back. People are saying print is my me time. And it's a kind of source of enhanced self-esteem as well. Mm. And it was interesting. Last week, there was a PPA conference here, which is, you know, one of the big industry conferences. And Tess McLeod-Smith, who's the publisher of Porter magazine, obviously the offshoot
which
of...
Which we're looking at here right now.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Perfect timing.
Right. Yes, very good. Good segue.
I hadn't realized. She said something really interesting too, that completely chimes with what we are seeing in terms of our research. Mm. And so I can quote her where she's saying, the reason that print is still so important to their audience, which is obviously a very upscale, affluent audience, is the emotional connection it brings, the touch and feel of the magazine, and a phrase I love, and I wish I'd come up with it myself, they're getting their, quote, tech detox time, which is kind of, you know, it's a great soundbite, but it absolutely chimes with what we're seeing at the moment, that there is this kind of feeling towards print that it's something special, something to relax with, and what we call a happy place, as opposed to this miserable workplace. Again, oversimplifying
sure,
it, but it's stressful, it's tense and all of that.
No disagreements from this side of the table, of course. When you look at, and it's a Porter magazine, and if for those listeners who have not come across it yet, this is the print spin-off of Net-a-Porter, which of course is the global luxury fashion e-commerce site. And it's also an interesting segue for us because it sits in this interesting world between, okay, we see the migration of maybe advertising going onto the cover of magazines, shock horror, and here you have this real hybrid that this is something which is launched from, of course, a business which is very commercial. They are in the business of selling clothes and, of course, working very closely with luxury goods advertisers. So it crisscrosses so many different boundaries, it breaks many rules of church and state. And yet it can still arrive on newsstands, Ian, and look, it looks like whether it's like Harper's Bazaar or whether it looks like it's a distant cousin of Vogue. It certainly achieves all of that. Now, we know there's a couple of issues around it. A lot of people saying, well, it's kind of a catalog in a way. So therefore, if I send my photographer to shoot for you, should they be shooting for the same rates that they would do editorially for Vogue or not? And a lot of pushback. Do we see more of the market going in this direction? Is this unique? What's your view?
I think people will be watching Porter very, very closely because they'll see whether or not they want to go in that direction as well. I think what's interesting to your point about this collision of different disciplines, obviously Porter started out with Net-a-Porter, which is basically an e-commerce site, a very good e-commerce site. But what they saw was that they needed print content around it to actually help create the brand because e-commerce is fine, but there's a big difference, as you know, between just an e-commerce site and a brand. There's a world apart. So that's why they started bringing in that kind of classic sort of branding content approach. And I think they're doing it really interestingly. And I think, you know, the jury is out at the moment because is it selling on the newsstand? I don't know. Does that even matter? I don't know. I suspect it probably doesn't matter because it's a fantastic global marketing device. And I think you have to look at Porter through a new lens. You look at it through the lens of marketing in a good sense, international, and as a way of really kind of developing the brand and also recruitment. Because again, print is a fantastic way of sampling. And that's the kind of magazine that will sit on a coffee table in an upscale flat in Helsinki or Buenos Aires or in Muswell Hill for the next 3 to 6 months. And a lot of the right people will pick that up, flick through it and go, if they hadn't heard of it, oh, that's interesting. What's this about? Oh, I can get it on my app. And that's precisely what they want. So I think what they're doing is a kind of long burn in terms of print, which offsets the obvious short term of the e-commerce.
And just before we go, it also forces a rethink, I guess, on the part of traditional players like yourselves and your big competitors, too, because also many of you are also in a bit of an e-commerce space or have, you know, big plans to be in that territory. So in a way, it also levels the playing field, too.
Absolutely. And, you know, the more people who do it and who experiment, the more we all learn. And also the more it helps educate the consumer because they're less and less concerned about traditional divisions. Oh, I'm not going there because that's tainted with some kind of filthy lucre or whatever.
Right. You know,
that's absurd. Yeah. That's not the way that kind of consumer. Net-a-Porter needs to become more and more, if you like, a credible brand.
Sure.
Within that more traditional setting. It's certainly got it on the e-commerce side. So I think we're all watching each other because, as we said earlier on, nobody's got the answers. There's no easy template. There's no easy business model anymore. They've all gone out the window.
Yeah.
So it's kind of step by step.
Ian Birch, always good to have you on board. Hopefully we'll get you back before everyone breaks for summer holidays because we'd love to sort of hear what goes into your tote bag before you head off to the countryside or the beach or onto the deck of a nice yacht or wherever you're going to be. But hopefully sometime in the next 5 weeks. I feel it's that time of year when all of these sort of, you know, we're hurtling to that close. September issues haven't come up yet. So we're putting everything else out to bed right now, which is exactly happening here
as
well.
Well, thank you for having me.
Not at all. Great to see you. That brings us to the end of this 92nd edition of The Stack with me, Tyler Burley. And again, special thanks, of course, to Ian Birch for being here today. If you have any comments or queries, then do drop us a note at info@monocle.com. Remember, we're back next Saturday at the very same time. And of course, you can always listen again at monocle.com or via iTunes or even via SoundCloud. But for now, until next time, goodbye.